Chapter 18. Official Letters to the Honorable American Congress. Here lived and labored the most felicitous letter writer in history, J. M. Toner, George Washington as an inventor. Besides encouraging numerous American authors, George Washington also assisted people engaged in other literary ventures. When Philadelphia publisher Matthew Carey launched the American Museum in 1787, for example, Washington subscribed to this monthly magazine. He enjoyed it very much, partly for Carey's sympathetic political stance, mainly for the magazine's eclectic contents. In large part, Carey drew his articles from previously published works, reprinting such recent American authors as Timothy Dwight, Benjamin Franklin, Francis Hopkinson, David Humphreys, and John Trumbull. Carey gave Washington and other subscribers the opportunity to reread important writings from the American Revolution. His choice of authors represents a groundbreaking effort in the formation of the canon of early American literature. Searching for possible documents to republish in the American Museum, Carey encountered a previously published Washington letter, so he requested his permission to reprint it. An Irishman by birth, Carey had not immigrated to America until after the Revolutionary War, so he was unfamiliar with the background of some of the literature published during the conflict. Washington clued him in, letting Carey know he had not written the letter at all. It was a forgery. By no means was it the only one. A pamphlet volume collecting several personal letters Washington had supposedly written had appeared in London in 1777 under the title Letters from General Washington to Several of His Friends in the Year 1776. These forgeries, now known as the Spurious Letters, were republished in the United States after copies of the pamphlet crossed the Atlantic. One letter appeared as a separate broadside publication, and loyalist printer James Rivington republished the rest of them in Rivington's Gazette. Editions of the complete volume also appeared in New York and Philadelphia. The spurious letters were war propaganda of the spiteful kind. They were designed to undermine the trust the American people had placed in General Washington. Though their precise authorship remains a mystery, these letters were written by someone with significant knowledge of Washington's personal life. Specific references to actual events lend an aura of truth to these blatant lies. The letters make Washington seem haughty, indecisive, self-serving, a loyalist in rebel's clothing. Years after the war, he still resented that his personal word had been sullied. He appreciated that Carey had had the courtesy to ask permission before reprinting the letter in question. Carey's request gave Washington a welcome opportunity to explain the nature of these mean-spirited misrepresentations. Even before he wrote him about the questionable letter, Carey had sought Washington's help with the American Museum. When he found it difficult to keep the magazine going, Carey had written him for assistance. Dismayed by the thought of the magazine's failure, Washington said its demise would be an impeachment on the understanding of this country. So far, he believed the American Museum had been edited with care, taste, and propriety, and found it eminently calculated to disseminate political, agricultural, philosophical, and other valuable information. Washington offered to do what he could to keep the American Museum afloat. His support helped sustain the magazine long enough to make it a landmark in Carey's career, a career that would establish him as the foremost publisher in Philadelphia during the late 18th and early 19th century. As a journalist, Carey bore witness to the emergence of the uniquely American system of party politics. When Washington was president, two dominant political parties emerged. His cabinet members took sides against each other in this burgeoning political conflict. Alexander Hamilton represented the ideals of a central national government with a strong fiscal policy that became known as federalism. Thomas Jefferson stood for republicanism, which recognized the rights and powers of individual states. Much might be said for both sides, Washington believed. Always a mediator, he tried to stay above such divisive politics. In this instance, he could not mask his preference for a strong federal government. President Washington became increasingly identified with federalism. Though a Washingtonian Federalist at first, Carey would later change his stripes and begin advocating the political views of Jeffersonian republicanism. Regardless, Carey never forgot Washington's assistance at a crucial moment in his career. In the coming years, he would elevate Washington's reputation further. As the publisher of Mason Locke Weems's best-selling Life of Washington, Carey would disseminate a biography that captured the popular imagination and that continues to shape the historical perception of George Washington. In light of Matthew Carey's success as an editor and publisher, his older brother John left their native Dublin for Philadelphia to see what he might accomplish in the bookselling line. Since John Carey had received an excellent classical education, he thought he might capitalize on his learning by buying and selling Greek and Latin classics. Like other attempts to turn knowledge into cash, John Carey's project was doomed from the start. Fewer and fewer people were learning the classics, which were slowly disappearing from the required curriculum of American colleges. In the early 1790s, John Carey placed several notices in the Philadelphia papers advertising classical books for sale, with little success. Around the same time, another Philadelphia bookseller, the one who was trying to sell William Byrd's classics-laden library, sadly realized that the Byrd books must remain on hand or be sold very low, and after they are picked, the rest will sell no more than waste paper. Loath to abandon the world of bookselling and publishing, John Carey shifted his attention from the ancient past to recent history, taking on a large-scale editorial project, a documentary history of the Revolutionary War. His brother gave him the idea. Many of the documents that Matthew Carey had published in the American Museum, after all, chronicle dramatic moments from the Revolutionary War. Matthew Carey's use of these documents in his periodical helped him see that they deserved more attention. Describing a key source for the material he reprinted in the American Museum, he told Washington, "For want of better resources, I am obliged at present frequently to recur to that corrupted publication, The Remembrancer." Denigrating his source, Matthew Carey hoped Washington would select some documents from his own papers to publish in the American Museum. Though still willing to help, Washington was far too busy to oblige in this instance. The specific work Matthew Carey mentioned was The Remembrancer, or Impartial Repository of Public Events, a monthly report of American news that the London publisher John Allman had issued from 1775 to 1784. Though a major source for understanding the war, The Remembrancer was riddled with errors, as Matthew Carey recognized. He told his brother to create a new edition of The Remembrancer, freshly editing from manuscript the most important letters and state papers of the American Revolution. John Carey took his brother's advice. In 1792, he solicited subscribers for this new work, placing advertisements in newspapers from Pennsylvania to South Carolina. According to his advertising copy, The American Remembrancer would include the proceedings of the Continental Congress, a collection of state papers from its files, letters written by leading figures during the Revolutionary War, and even some supposedly secret journals. Though Matthew Carey gave his brother the idea, The historical research of William Gordon really made John Kerry's project possible. Having worked hard to obtain access to U.S. government documents while researching the history of the American Revolution, Gordon paved the way for a documentary history of the war. John Kerry's request for permission to Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson clarifies his debt to Gordon. Encouraged by a resolution of Congress of May 25, 1784, allowing Mr. Gordon a free access to certain papers now in your office, I beg leave to request a similar indulgence if you see no impropriety in granting it. If permitted to copy out such of those papers as no longer require secrecy, I would wish to incorporate them, in their proper places, in an abridgment of the journals of the old Congress, which I mean to publish as soon as I shall have procured a sufficient number of subscribers. Jefferson granted him the requisite permission, and together they settled upon a course of action. Despite all his other responsibilities as Secretary of State, Jefferson would continue to assist John Kerry with his research. As Kerry worked his way through the material, he reconceived the project, narrowing its scope by limiting the number and type of documents he would include. He also jettisoned the title, American Remembrancer, which his brother would use for a different purpose. Whereas John Allman's Remembrancer published contemporary documents about the conflict between the United States and Great Britain, that is, documents about the war published during the war, John Kerry had conceived the American Remembrancer as a historical work, presenting documents about the war a dozen years after its end. Once John Kerry abandoned the title, Matthew reconceived the American Remembrancer, making it into a set of documents about an ongoing conflict between the United States and Great Britain. He decided to publish serially a set of essays, resolves, and speeches pertaining to Jay's Treaty. Since the end of the Revolutionary War, tension between Great Britain and the United States had re-escalated. The British were becoming more aggressive and belligerent in their dealings with the new nation. They refused to abandon their forts in the Great Lakes that were now on the American side of the border with Canada. After France declared war against Great Britain in 1793, the British had begun seizing American ships carrying goods to France. Washington commissioned John Jay to negotiate a settlement between the United States and Great Britain. Jay's Treaty, as it became known, left many Americans, Federalist and Republican, North and South, dissatisfied with its results. While the treaty did provide for the evacuation of British garrisons stationed in the Great Lakes, it contained few British concessions regarding neutral maritime rights. Matthew Kerry's American Remembrancer detailed the controversy over the treaty in great detail. Upon its completion, the work would fill three thick volumes. Washington would give the American Remembrancer a prominent place in his library at Mount Vernon. Letting his brother have the title American Remembrancer, John Kerry coined a new title for the collection of revolutionary documents he planned. American State Papers, being a collection of original and authentic documents relative to the war between the United States and Great Britain. He also formulated a new scheme for this edition, which was really quite shrewd. Instead of publishing all the pertinent documents in chronological order, he settled upon a thematic organization, choosing to edit and publish George Washington's wartime correspondence first, exclusive of everything else. A collection of letters by the President of the United States and the most revered man in America, John Kerry knew, would attract a much broader segment of the reading public than a collection of historical documents. Once John Kerry had copied numerous documents, he submitted them to Jefferson for his approval. Reading the material, Jefferson marked a few passages in the letters by Washington and his officers that he felt should be withheld from publication. He then submitted the letters with his edits to the president for his final approval. Washington read through them, approving Jefferson's suggestions and identifying a handful of other passages that should be withheld. Copying all these letters from the originals, Carey was not working alone. He hired two men from the State Department to help transcribe the documents he needed. Having decided to publish the book in London, Carey wished to expedite the editorial process. Since he planned to return to Great Britain before the men had finished copying all the documents he wanted, Carey arranged for Jefferson to have the manuscript copies sent to London. Hesitant to send the material directly to Carey, Jefferson mailed the manuscripts, which filled a dozen volumes, to Thomas Pinckney, U.S. Minister to Great Britain. Pinckney would hold on to them until Carey called for the manuscript volumes in person. Jefferson warned Pinckney not to share them with anyone else besides Carey. Should any accident happen to him, be pleased to retain them till further orders, as it is not meant to trust the publication to persons unknown. Carey's edition of Washington's letters came together with minimal input from the president. Beyond reading the edited letters that Jefferson submitted for his approval, Washington did nothing more to assist John Carey. He was too busy running the country to devote time to an edition of his letters. After war between France and Great Britain broke out, Washington held numerous cabinet meetings, which sometimes seemed like the war in microcosm. Fierce battles took place across the conference table, with Hamilton supporting the British and Jefferson taking France's side. Edmund Randolph, the Attorney General, was little help. Privately, Jefferson called him the poorest chameleon I ever saw, having no color of his own and reflecting that nearest him. When he is with me, he is a Whig. When with Hamilton, he is a Tory. When with the President, he is what he thinks will please him. As always, Washington was the man in the middle, listening to his cabinet ministers without taking sides, weighing the issues, and ultimately choosing a course of action that reconciled the differing points of view. The Anglo-French War significantly shaped American foreign policy, and in this instance resulted in the U.S. Neutrality Proclamation. The international conflict put Washington in a precarious position. He wanted to remain neutral toward both warring nations while maintaining the treaties of alliance and amity established between the United States and France in 1778, as well as the Treaty of Commerce. In addition, domestic conflicts were brewing to the west. Violence erupted in western Pennsylvania when revenuers attempted to serve papers on distillers who had not formally registered with the federal government. With fist and musket, the distillers resisted the imposition of federal excise taxes, which formed part of Alexander Hamilton's plan to fund the national debt. Washington denounced the violence and called for protesters to cease and desist. His proclamations fell on deaf ears. As this so-called Whiskey Rebellion continued, Washington himself led 12,000 troops into the region on October 1794. The distillers did not stand a chance against such an overwhelming force. Besides, they quivered at the thought of taking a shot at President Washington. What citizen would want to go down in history as the man who shot George Washington? The rebellion collapsed without further bloodshed. While Washington was preparing to face down a coterie of Pennsylvania distillers, the editor of his correspondence was busy bringing the book to completion. John Carey published his two-volume edition of Washington's wartime letters in April 1795. One title page identified the edition as part of American State Papers, but the Washington letters had a separate title page, Official Letters to the Honorable American Congress, written during the war between the United Colonies and Great Britain by His Excellency George Washington, Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Forces, now President of the United States. Kerry sent Washington two copies, one a handsomely bound presentation copy, the other in boards, a kind of temporary cardboard binding. The binding of the two-volume presentation copy was absolutely sumptuous, tree calf with gilt backs, borders, and edges. The copy in boards contained numerous marginal notes in which Kerry explained his editorial decisions. In his cover letter to Washington, Kerry described the marginalia in the volume as some manuscript remarks expressive of the motives that influenced me on the occasion. Official Letters to the Honorable American Congress begins in June 1775 with the first letter Washington wrote as Commander-in-Chief and continues through 1778. John Kerry had plenty more material edited and ready to publish, but a significant gap in General Washington's correspondence at the end of 1778 prompted him to stop his initial publication there. He was still planning to continue the edition as long as it remained profitable. The two-volume edition of Washington's official letters was well received. William Enfield began his review with the following observations. It may perhaps be hazarded as a general remark that great men are commonly distinguished by a peculiar simplicity of style. Caesar wrote the history of his wars almost without metaphor. Franklin, whether he wrote as a philosopher, i.e. scientist, as a moralist, or as a politician, always expressed himself with a luminous and dignified simplicity. And this is eminently the literary character of the official letters of Washington, here presented to the public. In this view, they afford an excellent specimen of the proper style for letters or papers on public transactions. Continuing his comments, Enfield observed that Washington's letters exhibit a most interesting and wonderful example of the firm intrepidity with which a great and honest mind engaged in a noble cause can struggle with difficulties and at last overcome them. And at the same time, they furnish an instructive lesson to the world on the folly of attempting to crush the rising spirit of freedom. Enfield's remarks appeared in the Monthly Review, a Whig publication that had long expressed sympathy with the American cause. The Critical Review, a competing Tory publication, also reviewed official letters positively. Impressed with Washington's personality, the reviewer thought his letters would appeal to readers in many walks of life. Statesmen and soldiers would find in them the profound observations of superior genius. Those wishing to understand history could read the work to witness the historical cause and effect process. All readers would find instruction and amusement sufficient to let them behold such singular events related with all the truth and feelings of the moment and by the chief actor concerned in that surprising revolution. The Critical Review also praised the literary qualities of these letters. The style of Washington is that of a superior character, clear and manly, expressing even great events and profound ideas with all the simplicity of genius. Firm, collected, pregnant in resources, while affairs are adverse, modest, severe, prepared for any change of fortune while she smiles. An uniform vigor, an untainted patriotism distinguish the illustrious writer and pervade his whole correspondence. The British critic was more tempered in its remarks. While suggesting that those interested in history would find little new information in this collection, it did praise Washington's literary style. In these letters, the critic observed, he expresses himself with great elegance and force of language, and with liberality of sentiment, as well as prudence, sagacity, and judgment. The critic was especially impressed by the circumstances of their composition. Though written during times of imminent danger, difficulty, and distress, the letters are remarkable for precision, force, and correctness, great accuracy of detail, and great perspicuity of arrangement. As all these reviews suggest, official letters established George Washington's reputation as a major voice in the history of early American literature. Besides highlighting Washington's literary skill, official letters also reveals Carey's editorial ability. Closing the first volume with the famous Crossing of the Delaware, Carey effectively created a cliffhanger ending that would make readers eager to start the second volume. In the next-to-last letter of the first volume, that of December 27, 1776, Washington reports the Army's success to the Continental Congress. Landon Carter's appreciative remarks about Washington's portrayal of the Siege of Boston also apply to the letter about crossing the Delaware and attacking the Hessian troops quartered at Trenton. This letter, too, is a magnum in parvo, a brief account that captures the bravery, the danger, the grandeur of the experience. Washington had already proven his ability to describe an icy river crossing in The Journal of Major George Washington. He did not play up the dramatic elements in his description of this new wintertime river crossing in the letter to the Continental Congress. He did mention the chunks of ice in the river early on, mainly to explain why it took him and his men so long to cross. It was 3 o'clock in the morning before they transported all the artillery across, and 4 by the time the men began their march. Washington's depiction of the momentous events creates considerable tension. Would the delays stop the American troops from approaching Trenton under the cloak of darkness? Would it give the Hessians time to prepare for the American assault? Returning to the icy, treacherous conditions toward the end of the letter, Washington did so mainly to praise the dedication of the men who served under him. In justice to the officers and men, I must add that their behavior upon this occasion reflects the highest honor upon them. The difficulty of passing the river in a very severe night, and their march through a violent storm of snow and hail, did not in the least abate their ardor. But when they came to the charge, each seemed to vie with the other in pressing forward. And were I to give a preference to any particular corps, I should do great injustice to the others. In the last letter of the first volume, that of December 29th, Washington is on the verge of attempting a second crossing of the Delaware. Carey may have ended the volume here because he had reached the end of 1776, but this ending also contributes to the drama, leaving Washington, after one victory, about to attempt another, the outcome of which remains unknown as the first volume comes to a close. Publishing Washington's letters in London, Carey edited them more heavily than he would have edited them had he published them in the United States. He omitted some passages from the letters he thought might offend British readers. Carey need not have worried. The editorial omissions actually had the opposite effect, as the response of one reader suggests. One day, Carey happened to have coffee in London with a man who was quite knowledgeable when it came to American affairs. The man had read Washington's official letters, but since Carey kept his editorship anonymous, the man was unaware of his role in their publication. He criticized the editor of the letters for having suppressed a number of the most interesting passages and presented the public with little better than the chaff. This irate reader recalled some passages the editor had purposely omitted. Carey was so flabbergasted that he cut short their conversation and never learned how this mystery man knew about passages from letters that Carey had read in manuscript yet excluded from his edition. The explanation may be simpler than Carey realized. William Gordon had used many of the same Washington letters in The History of the Rise, Progress, and Establishment of the Independence of the United States of America. Furthermore, Gordon had been bolder in his use of the documents, quoting the best parts of some letters without overthinking the propriety of his quotations. Carey's coffeehouse acquaintance obviously knew Gordon's history. He recognized passages Carey omitted because Gordon had already quoted them. Though Carey sympathized with the American cause, His decision to publish Washington's official letters in London reflects an underlying British bias. An Irishman by birth, Carey considered London the center of the English-speaking world and the capital of English book publishing. Like William Gordon before him, Carey believed the best way to establish himself and his book would be to publish it in London. For all his shrewdness in publishing a collection of Washington's letters, he seems to have ignored the fact that the book would appeal much more to American readers than to British ones. Carey apparently assumed that American booksellers would import his edition and sell it to their customers. He did not foresee that American publishers could reprint the work for less than it would cost to import his London edition. Furthermore, they would not have to pay him any royalties or permission fees for reprinting his edition. Since there was no international copyright, American publishers were free to reprint Washington's official letters without remunerating its editor. One Boston edition appeared before the end of 1795, with a second the following year. A New York edition appeared in 1796. Sales of the London edition did not encourage Carey to continue either the collection of Washington letters or American state papers. In the preface to the first volume of Official Letters, he looked forward to future volumes, explaining to readers that if the initial volumes met with a favorable reception, he would edit and publish additional ones, presenting a variety of interesting pieces penned by the leaders and principal agents in the American Revolution. Disappointed with the commercial failure of Official Letters, Carey discontinued American state papers altogether. The commercial success of the American reprints, on the other hand, encouraged publishers in the United States to issue other compilations of Washington letters. Unwittingly, John Carey contributed to these unauthorized sequels. His promise of further volumes gave American publishers the opportunity to promote alternate editions of Washington letters, making the new releases seem like the sequels Carey had promised. In December 1795, a Philadelphia publisher issued Letters from General Washington to Several of His Friends in June and July 1776, in which is set forth an interesting view of American politics at that all-important period. According to its title page, this pamphlet was republished at the Federal Press. But this imprint is a ruse. The work was printed by none other than Benjamin Franklin Bache, who had taken it upon himself to lead the attack on Washington's administration. Over time, Bache's critiques of the president in the Aurora grew more and more radical and erratic. This pamphlet represents another salvo in Bache's incessant barrage. Its fictitious imprint gives the impression that the Federalists had approved and sanctioned the publication of these letters. What Bache published was actually a reprint of the spurious letters originally issued as anti-American propaganda during the war. Identifying the volume as a republication of an out-of-print work in his preface, Bache deliberately linked this collection with Carey's, asserting that Washington's personal correspondence would furnish an interesting appendix to the official letters of General Washington, which have lately made their appearance. Bache released Letters from General Washington in the aftermath of Jay's Treaty. He had been the one who first made the terms of Jay's Treaty public in early 1795. Incensed by the treaty, Bache sought to expose what he perceived as its inherent dangers. He designed this edition to create further animosity, demonstrating the affection the president supposedly had for England, which Jay's treaty seemed to validate. Another edition of Washington letters appeared the following year under the title Epistles Domestic, Confidential, and Official. James Rivington issued this collection, though without his imprint. Like Bache, Rivington associated his edition with Carey's official letters. The main text reprinted the same spurious letters Bache had reprinted, and a lengthy appendix reprinted many of Washington's previously published letters. Washington could not let this misleading collection pass without comment. Once Epistles Domestic, Confidential, and Official appeared, he denounced the fraudulent collection in a letter to Timothy Pickering, the current Secretary of State. Pickering published Washington's letter in the United States Gazette. It was subsequently printed as a small broadside, the same size as an octavo page, and bound with some copies of the book. After a London edition of Epistles Domestic, Confidential, and Official appeared, John Kerry could not ignore the collection either. Reviewing the book anonymously for the September 1796 issue of the Critical Review, he denounced the collection of domestic letters as a forgery. To be sure, he could recognize political propaganda when he saw it. These letters, Kerry surmised, were assembled by Washington's opponents to mislead the new generation that has sprung up since the war and the numerous emigrants who have settled in America within the last 20 years. Kerry sent Washington a copy of the Critical Review containing his notice of Epistles Domestic, Confidential, and Official. Washington acknowledged Kerry's gift, inscribing a note to that effect into the issue, which he added to his excellent collection of periodicals at Mount Vernon. Though Kerry never turned a profit with official letters to the Honorable American Congress, he deserves credit for assembling the letters that comprise the edition. The first published collection of Washington's correspondence, official letters, looked forward to the numerous multi-volume editions of Washington's letters and papers that have since appeared. When Jared Sparks outlined his plan for an extensive edition of Washington's writings in the 19th century, he acknowledged Kerry's official letters as his predecessor. And the editors of the ongoing edition of The Papers of George Washington owe a debt to John Kerry for his pioneering editorial work. Before Sparks published his edition of Washington's papers, official letters continued to be read and cited. The Reverend Dr. William Lynn, for example, read the letters as a gauge of Washington's character. Though the letters chronicled Washington's wartime activities, Lynn found that they reflected his statesmanship as well. Official letters reminded a Maryland reader of an earlier battlefield commander, the prominent leader of the Wars of Scottish Independence. This reader observed that the letters Washington wrote from New York in September 1776 evoked the somber mood among the Continental troops. Sir William Wallace, in the most gloomy era of his ill-fated country, never encountered greater difficulties than did Washington at this period, and no man can peruse his official letters to Congress of that date without bowing in unspeakable reverence at the moral sublimity of his character. Others read the edition for different purposes. Historian John Adolphus used official letters to learn the background of the Revolutionary War as he wrote his History of England. Etymologist John Pickering scrutinized Kerry's edition with an eye toward understanding Washington's use of language. Pickering recognized General Washington's willingness to add new words to the English language when current ones were inadequate. And Adjutant General Thomas H. Cushing read Washington's official letters to help conduct the War of 1812, to understand, for example, the proper proportion of Army officers to enlisted men. For many book collectors of the time, official letters to the Honorable American Congress possessed the quality of a talisman. It gave them a little piece of Washington all their own. From medals to mezzotints, Washington memorabilia adorned American homes in the late 18th and early 19th century. In terms of both symbolic and practical value, a book of his writings could do more than any of these decorative keepsakes. It provided Washington's words, words he had written himself, words that expressed his personality, his belief in the new nation, his confidence in his men, and his strength of character. Washington's wartime letters demonstrate that he knew what he had to do as commander-in-chief, what Congress had to do to support the war, and what it took to win the war and establish the nation on a firm footing.